The first reading this morning comes from the blog of the Reverend Michael Spencer, a retired evangelical minister with a heartfelt and broad-minded approach to Scripture. He wrote these words in an essay 3 years ago about the topic that I'll be talking on this morning.
If a person does not believe that prudence and wisdom need to accompany generosity, consider this situation. John and Jenny are at the movies. They come out and a panhandler asks for $20 for gas. Jenny gives it to him and the couple skips dinner altogether. The next day, Jenny and John are enrolling in college. A panhandler meets Jenny on the steps of the administration building and asks for $2,000 to fly to his mother's funeral in the Solomon Islands. Jenny has the money in her checkbook. Should she write the check? If not, why not? If prudence and wisdom should come into play with $2,000, then it should also come into play with 20.
The second reading this morning is the beautiful poem called Song by Dina Metzger, written 21 years ago. I'm going to ask Steve to read it through twice, since it's quite short but very powerful. I'm hoping before the end of the service to actually memorize it.
There are those who are trying to set fire to the world. We are in danger. There is time only to work slowly. There is no time not to love. There are those who are trying to set fire to the world. We are in danger. There is time only to work slowly. There is no time not to love.
My eldest godson, Adam Zepka, has a friend named Kaveh who makes films. When I was visiting Adam and Kaveh in Montreal a few years ago, Kaveh told us about a project he was working on to shoot a documentary on a man who had been living in the main Paris airport for over 10 years. This fellow never left the airport. He ate there. He slept there. He used their bathrooms. 10 years. Unlike the fellow and his son, in this morning's story for the children. This man was quite open about his situation, and he spent no time trying to hide the fact that he was there. Everybody knew it. The short film was completed. It's called Sayeh, S-A-Y-E-H, Sayeh. You can look it up. Maybe you'll get to see it sometime. The man Kaveh filmed was not an easy subject. He was deeply emotional, not in a healthy way, and he was beginning to crack apart. Living in an airport for 10 years may keep you warm in the winter, cool in the summer, and dry in spring and autumn, but this man's lack of options was wearing him to a frazzle. Yes, his was a political situation, apparently. He was a refugee from another country who had no easy answers to his dilemma. But then I have to imagine that the man in the story we heard earlier this morning was not really in a situation that was too much different in most ways. Now, don't get me wrong. I actually do know people who have chosen to leave the shelters and homes that they have lived in for a long time for life on the open streets. My neighbor Oliver in Oakland did that when I lived there. He felt that his mother's house, which was right across the street from my own, was too crowded. She was always, as he put it, taking in strays. And he felt that privacy, sleeping under a bridge at night, was far better than all the commotion in the stuffed house at home. I know folks who prefer the streets to shelters for other reasons. Some of them feel that shelters are threatening places filled with desperate and violent types. But most people on the street who are not professional beggars, and yes, professional beggars do exist, are not there because they think it's a better place to be than a nice warm home someplace. Some of them are emotionally disturbed folks who have fallen through the cracks in our system, for which funding diminishes daily, I'm sorry to say. Some are folks going through terrible but temporary crises in their lives. Many, like the man in the story this morning, actually have jobs that they go to every day, but they're not able to afford an apartment in a neighborhood with good schools for their children. Many others do not have work, and they live on meals that folks in our church and others cook for Faith Mission or some other shelter program, and then spend the night in group dorms. Some of these folks make their way to our building in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. Our doors are unlocked most of the day. Sometimes folks come in when I am here and they knock at the office door and I go talk with them. Sometimes they come in when Eric is here and he responds to them. Sometimes they come in when you are here and neither Eric or I are here. Perhaps someone is going to come in to a meeting that you're at, or knock at your covenant group door, or come into the room where you're having a small supper and talk to you. Perhaps this someone will ask you for money. What are you going to do then? Will you reach into your wallet or purse or pocket and hand over some change, some bills? Why or why not? What's your reasoning? We say all are welcome here, often, but does that only mean people who have divergent ideas as to the meaning of the word God or the teachings of Jesus? Or does that mean someone who asks you for cash? These, I say, are all spiritual questions, questions of spiritual accountability. To be accountable is to be answerable to someone or some group or some ideal we profess that makes demands upon us. But is our answer, when we are answerable, accountable, is it yes or no? Or something else? Why? Again, more spiritual questions. Now, I have talked with many folks in this congregation over the last 3 years, and I have heard different answers expressed in the conversations. Here are some of them. Some say, well, just give. After all, it's better to give than receive, and I have more than that person who's asking me, so it's only fair that I should give. Some say, don't ever give. How can you know if they really need something good for them, like food or shelter, or they just want money for drugs and alcohol? Some say, I'm afraid. So I give to make them go away, so I feel safe. Others say, oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. Those who feel afraid are really saying they just don't like to see people so down and out because it makes them feel uncomfortable. That's not really fear. Some others say, I feel guilty when someone asks me for money, so I give so as not to feel guilty. Even if the story they are telling me is an out-and-out lie, and I know it. Others say, feeling guilty is just a waste of time. It's simply not right to give money away just like that because someone asks. If you give money to one, they will tell others out in the streets that this church is an easy mark. And the next day, the floodgates are going to open up, and all of a sudden, we are a social service agency without a cent of state funding. And no longer a church. Now, this last statement is actually quite interesting to me because it's been brought up for almost 1,800 years. The ancient Roman writer, Lucian of Antioch, wrote a story satirizing the Christian Marcion, where he depicted him as a devious man who pretended to be in great need. The local church community he joined heaped lavish gifts on him, giving him food and money and shelter, till, Lucian says, he was richer than all of them. When the church figured this out, they got angry and they chased him away. And then he became a cynic philosopher, giving away all of his possessions and all of his money and living on the street. And the reading offered us by Michael Spencer is interesting to me, too. He speaks of prudence and wisdom being part of our answer, part of our accountability to any request made of us. If someone asks us for $20 and we give it, why won't we give $2,000 when someone asks that of us? He is comparing and contrasting the two situations and asking us if it's only the amount that makes the difference. This, too, as far as I'm concerned, is a deeply spiritual question worth meditating upon. I know that when I am asked for money, sometimes I am annoyed that my day is being interrupted by someone telling me a story I simply cannot verify at that moment. Your car broke down? Your daughter needs a meal? You need to go to your mother's funeral? How do I know that? And yet, I tell myself, it could be true, couldn't it? And maybe I do have 20 bucks in my pocket at the time. But I have a lot of things to do, a hospital visit, an important meeting, a counseling session for someone who is depressed and miserable, or maybe even this sermon to compose? Can I take time away from my commitments to try and decide whether there is a funeral or not someplace by checking all the records on my computer? At my former congregation, someone drove up the driveway and asked me for gas money to get to his mother's funeral up in Spokane, Washington. He needed, he said, exactly $37.26 to make that trip. He told me he had calculated that it would take that much, exactly, and that he didn't want to be greedy and ask for any more. Well, I thought that was an interesting approach, so I gave him the money. Next week, someone else came up the driveway. Mother, funeral, Spokane, $37.26. Same details. I didn't have any cash on me that day. Honestly, I told him so. But a week later, same story. Same details, but another man. I just sent him away and said, "This church has a policy of not giving any of our budget away to individuals, but only to social causes." After that, no one came back to ask for gas money to get to a funeral in Spokane. And at that moment, I realized there is some truth in what is said about not allowing the beat on the street to be that this church is an easy mark. Tell them a sob story and you'll get anything you ask for. This holy hesitation is what Michael Spencer calls wisdom and prudence. But wisdom and prudence learned, I think, by me, not at my university, but rather in the often more important school of hard knocks. Of course, the needs are real, and not everyone has got a con story. Most of the stories I hear, I dare say, are as real as rock. But am I the best person to respond to individuals, or should I focus on organizations who help mitigate the terrible problems of people who have fallen through the cracks of our very well-cracked social system? Again, these are all spiritual questions, and I can think of no easy answers to any of these spiritual questions I have raised. I'm sorry. The man at the airport in our story this morning is a fictional character based on a non-fictional real person. But this week, I helped a real person, my friend Warren, move into an apartment, the first apartment he has lived in for 5 years. He's been on the street all that time, living in shelters, sleeping on couches, sometimes my couch. And yes, he is a real friend of mine, not a case I'm working on, not a charity. I care deeply about Warren, and he has stayed in my house many times to get out of the cold. He had a problem with alcohol for a while, and I had to keep him out of my life for a very long time. But our friendship is real and has survived his sad, destructive way of coping with his undeniably difficult situation. Other friends have asked me why I have a homeless friend. Isn't that odd, they ask. I say, I have him as a friend for the same reason that I have you as a friend. I love you. I love Warren, too. It may seem like some to be an overused word, love. Never for me. There is no time not to love, writes Dina Metzger. No time not to love. Spencer tells us that love needs to be wise and prudent, not profligate and senseless, and I agree with that, too. But I like what Dina Metzger says just before she tells us that there is no time not to love. She reminds us that there is danger in the world. There are those, she says, who are trying to set the world on fire. But I, for one, don't think she's talking about the folks who might walk into this building looking for a handout. I think the really dangerous ones are the people who tell me they can offer me something for nothing, that they can give me a big deal if I will only trust them. I think the really dangerous ones are not the ones who need food and shelter and sometimes tell big whopping lies to try and get them, but the ones who have large homes and plenty of food, but who try and tell me that they have the one true scheme that will make my life instantaneously better if only I will give them huge sums of money and time. Like the television ads I see that go on and on broadcasting, "It's my money and I want it now." 1,000 get-rich-quick schemes, lotteries, casinos, instant loan sharks, free trips to the Bahamas that you have won, the TV evangelists who tell you that God will favor you by doubling your bank account if only you will plant a $3,000 seed in their garden. None of these people love you. None of them love me. They are not my friends, and they are not your friends. They are not speaking of honest needs like food and shelter. For me, anyone who preaches that you can get something for nothing is the real danger, not the homeless person who comes into this building asking for food and money. It's hard for me to even get upset if someone comes in here trying to swindle me with a tall tale when I can see the world of Wall Street and Madison Avenue and many of the major corporations is packed with far more terrible swindlers of a more voracious and guilt-free sort, as the sinking economy in the last 2 years has proven with painful clarity. Dina Metzger says, "There is time only to work slowly." So it is with the spiritual questions I asked earlier in the sermon. If you think I'm going to offer you a cipher to answer the question, do we give when asked or do we not, then you neither know me well nor our religious tradition very well. Being answerable, fully answerable and accountable is not having any final and universally applied answers applicable to everybody. Being accountable is not setting up account charts of yes or no. It's to be part of a story that's open-ended, that has elements that will always be unknown, but which, Dina Metzger reminded us in the affirmation, can be transformed. How? By our slow work, by our patience, by our continuing conversations, open and not critical of each other's thoughts in a negative way, but continuing the conversations about this exact topic, because it's never going to stop. How? By our willingness to be compassionate, not just towards those who come to us, but toward ourselves. When we make mistakes, when we get taken, when we get frustrated by the whole situation, that there are two classes of people in America, the housed and the homeless. We can't know the entire story of anyone's life, including our own. There are always new learnings, deeper understandings that can break through if we are open-ended. It's even best not to know the entire story, says Metzger, because if we think we do, if we think we know the right answer in every case, we're outside the story. I think that's a brilliant statement. But in our religious tradition, the housed and the homeless are both part of the unfolding, unfinished story. Warren and I are part of the same story. You and I, and even the homeless fellow we had to ask to leave this building permanently because he blew up the microwave in our kitchen and almost burned us down, are all part of the same story. the story of people yearning to love more, to be loved more, live justly, find joy, find freedom, like the bird in the story Jennifer told the children this morning. Remember how it ended? Then I remembered the bird. It took a while, but a door opened. And when the bird left, when it flew free, I know it was singing. I don't know if that filmmaker, Kaveh, would ever find a reason to make a documentary about this congregation. But I bet if he did, when he heard us keeping the conversation going about real people, the housed and the homeless, the questioning and the answering, figuring out how to live our common story together fairly, justly, and honestly with care and love, I think he might end up with a real film festival award winner on his hands. And I bet you his title would be, "The Earth is Whole."